What's up, listeners? Another episode of Escape from Plan A for you. And I think everyone knows what we're here to talk about, but introducing me, Chris, your host, here with Jess and Teen. What's up, guys?
Hey, what's going on?
Yeah, so a little thing happened very recently. What happened again? You guys want to discuss?
Skip the banter. Let's get right into it.
Yeah, our film is finished.
No. Yeah. I meant the Harvard decision. I was
the fucking
coy.
Harvard decision.
We're talking about the real stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our short film. Yes. I mean, that's
to nobody's surprise. The Supreme Court came out 6-2. It wasn't 6-3 because Ketanji Jackson Brown, I think, was on one of the relevant boards at Harvard.
Yeah, she recused herself.
So she had to recuse herself. But she did write, you know, she did provide a dissenting opinion, a much maligned opinion by the majority. And I think I read through Robert's opinion. That was the majority opinion. And I think all six justices on that side, you know, concurred in that opinion. So that is the majority opinion. And it seems, from my read of it, yeah, affirmative action, as we know it, is dead. That is how I read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I knew that it was coming out sometime towards the end of June, it's just like I totally forgot about it and be like, oh, damn, and this happened. And yeah, as you said, we all knew this would happen just based on what, you know, obviously the court's leaning right wing. And I think after the oral arguments, people were pretty, like, you could tell the court had made up its mind, but you know, everyone had their tweets ready to go and all that shit.
That shit was drafted long before the ruling. But just as a little exercise for at least this pod, let's stay away from talking about things as like right wing or left wing, just as a little exercise, because I think in this is one of the few like Supreme Court rulings that I've ever like read, as opposed to just
too.
you know like skimming it.
At least ever since law school.
I mean, I remember doing that for like debate team in high school. But like, you know, I was barely paying attention even then too. This is the first one that I actually like tried to read. And one of the big things that jumps out at me is how different the news is about it versus what it actually is on paper. What is actually being argued. I think that's probably true for probably all of these cases. What it's presented in the media is, I guess, what Chris Hedges would call a pseudo event. Basically just sound bites more designed for entertainment and like emotional release than anything substantive. Because it's so misleading that it's almost counterfactual the way it's presented in the press.
Yeah, and I have this piece I'm going to publish on my Substack. It's called Sally or Redemption. Show me some love, listeners. Go subscribe. But
the Substack is called Sally or Redemption, not the piece.
Oh, yeah. No, that would make absolutely no sense.
Okay.
But
I want to make that clear.
Yeah. But yeah, it is this. Nobody really cares about the law. It is really an expression of emotion, which ultimately comes down to, like, do we think diversity is a worthy goal that should be pursued in all aspects of society, from, you know, the top level government to in your personal lives? That's what people are really debating. Like, I have not really read, I think, a Supreme Court decision, probably since law school, especially nowadays, since I'm not even a litigator, although I am a lawyer still. And, you know, nobody really cares about the law. This is all about what we feel like society should be doing. And if the law happens to kind of intertwine with that, great. But that's what it's really about, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very lazy and undisciplined. It's people projecting their own personal wish list of things that they want out of things without understanding anything that's actually going into it. And that's not to sound paternalistic necessarily. It's saying, like, there's a structure and function to this that people are completely ignoring. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the Supreme Court, which is still a court, so they can only respond to cases brought to it, right? Which can only be challenges to laws that have been passed, right?
Yes, and it has to be a suit that's brought by someone who has the proper, quote, standing to actually even bring the suit, which is actually like a big controversy in that other big case that came, the other big decision that came down about, I think it was called Groff or something like that. It was this other one about, you know, a woman who didn't want to make wedding cakes for gay couples, but she didn't actually have a cake business. She was like thinking about building a cake business. And so there was a lot of question about whether she had adequate standing to actually bring the case, since she couldn't really demonstrate harm. And if you notice in the beginning, the Supreme Court does go through whether this SFFA organization actually has standing to sue, whether Ed Blum has any standing, and whether these Asian students actually became a meaningful, you know, did they suffer any meaningful harm? And a lot of people said no, they don't, because they went to some other school. So fuck them, right? So, the Supreme Court rejected all of the standing challenges, and I think the lower courts did too. So that wasn't at issue, I think, in SFFA. There was a proper dispute here.
Yeah, I skipped those parts. Like when I was reading through this decision, it seemed like more of a formality. But
in this case,
I've been reading through not only the Supreme Court decision, but also the the First Circuit decision, which, you know, this court is like reviewing. As I was writing my piece for the Substack,
that's the intermediate appellate court, right? Right.
Yeah. For all you non-lawyers out there, essentially at the federal level, there are three levels of the court. There's a district court. So this was first heard in the District Court of Massachusetts. Some big states have like multiple district courts. Like California has what, like three? But Massachusetts only has one. Heard it there, then it goes up another level, which is the first district court, which is, you know, encompasses several states. I believe New York's in the second
yes. Yeah, we're second.
Yeah, that's how rusty I am. And then they supported the lower court, and now it goes up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court is obviously the top level. It gets to essentially have final say on everything. So I was reading through that. And
SFFA lost in both lower courts, right?
Yeah. But levels. I'm sure they were like, didn't care because they knew. Well, I don't know what the Supreme Court makeup was at the time when it first appeared at the district court level. I think it was 2018, 2019. So I'm not quite sure what the court makeup was. But hey, Trump was in office at the time, so they probably knew if we could get this to the Supreme Court, we can win. So we don't care if we lose at the kind of like minor league level. But anyway, was it last night I called you, Teen, where I was like, I'm going through this First Circuit decision. I'm going through this regression analysis of the personal score. I want to make sure I'm understanding this because I don't have a degree in, you know, hieroglyphics.
Statistics.
I don't quite understand this. And you're like, bro, chill out. Didn't even talk about this in the Supreme Court decision. I'm like, damn, you're right. Yeah. Teen, you want to talk more about that? Like, what exactly is the Supreme Court decision saying?
Well, hold on. Just one quick comment on the reaction that I'm seeing. And just coming from a complete non-law background, just tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think I'm correct here. The Supreme Court, nothing the Supreme Court, or really any like judicial branch, any element, any agent of the judicial branch can do, they can't make law, right? They can they can uphold a law, they can strike it down, but they can't exactly uphold laws that don't exist.
Yeah, that's the legislative branch's
duty. So it seems like in this case, and I've seen hints of this in others, although I haven't read those rulings, it seems like a lot of the popular reaction is, well, in a proper world, this should have been law, but they're actually bound to, they can't do anything about that. So the challenge is,
hold on. What do you mean what should have been law?
It seems like the popular reaction to this, it seems like the majority opinion, criticizes the dissent for this, that they are not citing proper case law or any precedent for their opinions, that they're basically talking about a world they wished they lived in, essentially.
You mean the dissent? That the dissent is doing?
Or the popular reaction to stuff like this, right? In a proper, in their ideal world, there would have been strong laws, you know, upholding, you know, racial quotas, or, you know, pro affirmative action, you know, stronger statutes supporting the policies that they wanted.
There are statutes that do that.
Yeah, but you know, I'm just talking about like the procedure of this, right? Like the Supreme Court or any court, they can't exactly uphold a law that doesn't exist.
Right. That's long been the accusation often by conservatives against activist judges, that they're stepping over a line of merely reviewing existing law and going out of their way to create law. And I think it just goes to our point where nobody, at least, you know, the popular discourse, like nobody really cares about what exactly the divisions of the government are. They're just voicing their emotional desires of what should be, and, you know, the law, who cares? It's boring, fuddy-duddy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing I want to point out here is that it's just notable in, like, another, you know, real, like, a real touch point here is the abortion issue, right? We tend to hyper-focus on Supreme Court rulings about that, but there hasn't really been any change on the legislative side in decades at this point.
Oh, yeah, and I think that there was a famous Reuters article from 2009 where I think it was a reporter from Reuters who asked Obama whether, now that he had a supermajority of the Senate and held the House, whether they were going to go ahead and codify Roe. And he said, absolutely not, because, you know, it's like, I think Roe is sufficient for now. And, you know, we want to keep our powder dry because there's other priorities right now. And they didn't want to do it. And I think the reason they didn't want to do it is because, exactly for that reason, is that the Supreme Court is really not politically, it's not politically accountable to people, and by design, right? These are not elected judges.
It's kept as, it's almost weaponized then.
Exactly.
It's not in the law. Yeah. It's kept precarious. It's subject to challenge. So this is a real, it's a real, you know, damning thing.
Yeah, and they're caricaturized. These people are, you know, we caricaturize them on the liberal to conservative spectrum. So we've been taught to hate originalists. We've been taught to hate Scalia. I'm not saying we should love Scalia, but in hindsight, I think what Scalia had been saying all along as an originalist was saying, you know, we really don't think that nine people in an unelected body as the Supreme Court is a secure way to if you want that right to protect abortions. The originalists on the court were very clear. They said the Constitution is not going to stand in the way of such a law, but you need to pass that law. But what have liberals been saying? It's the Supreme Court's fault. And very few people reference Obama's failure to pursue codification when the political situation was in that favor. They didn't do it because they, like you said, I mean, there are probably a lot of lawmakers on the Democratic side that could possibly lose their seat if they started to expend political capital towards such a project. And so the natural answer was, well, the Supreme Court seems like they've got it, right? It was the originalists that were saying, no, this is not safe, you know? And ultimately Scalia wasn't even part of the court that overturned Roe.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people would have done better to not caricaturize Scalia. And now people are caricaturizing, and I would add in a very racist way, Thomas as well. They caricaturize him as an idiot who's basically illiterate and is only on there because he was, you know, George W. Bush's coon or whatever, you know, or, you know, some really racist, pejorative notion of Thomas.
Man, it really went mask off.
It's disgusting. It is disgusting. I'm not saying you have to like Thomas. I'm not saying that you have to agree with Thomas. But I think some of the liberal caricature of him has shaded into some of the most racist shit I've ever seen.
I mean, tying it back into this decision.
High U.S. official who's black. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Sorry for cutting off. No, I mean, just the past couple of days, I've seen so many takes that basically boil down to Clarence Thomas was helped by affirmative action, and how dare he betray us?
Oh yeah, they said he was helped by affirmative action, and so he should have gotten in line. As if they're like, I'm like, dude, you, this is so not the level at which this case is being decided. Everyone out there on Twitter, like, you know, giving their little racist takes or dunking on this court, you know, this judge or that. I'm like, you don't know anything. Like, you don't even know the basics, so just please shut up. But yes, this has all been politicized and weaponized, and everyone thinks that their take matters. And I'm like, go read the opinion, see if you can understand it, and then maybe tease out what's actually going on. And then we can have a conversation about it.
But, yeah, I will say, you know, maybe it's because I was the last time I did this, I was reading like stuff from the Warren Court or like 100 years ago. So the language was too impenetrable. When
it has gotten more readable over time.
It is. So if anybody is just kind of intimidated or doesn't want to, it's very, very readable. I feel like it's at the level of like a history textbook, honestly.
Yeah, not much Latin, so don't be scared off.
Yeah. You know,
so, funny enough, this is a very simple case. This does not involve like a very, you know, a lot of the stuff the Supreme Court does is like very technical. It involves a lot of like very technical stuff and procedural histories and, you know, whatever. This is a very like basic case when it comes to the application of
There's like three cases that form like 90% of their sites. You know, it's not exactly a hugely ideologically complicated. Why don't we go through those? Hmm? Yeah. So like just I broke it down in our outline as just it helped me think about it this way. Like what does this case actually entail? Right. And what does it not entail? I feel like the popular reaction to it got everything about that incorrect.
Right.
Okay. People weren't talking about things that it was actually at stake and projecting a whole bunch of stuff that had nothing to do with this case onto it.
Right. Yeah. They're just projecting their ideal society. They're like, you know, progressive, diverse society. But yeah, let's get down to the cases.
Again, yeah, so let's go through it.
Yeah, guys, feel free to jump in. I'll just lay an outline. I'm sure I'll get things wrong. So, you know, jump in. So let's start with Backe, which is the thing that gets cited a lot. So there's this case that comes out saying, okay, what the hell is affirmative action for? Is it to make up for all the, you know, crimes of slavery, Jim Crow, Reconstruction, all that? Or is it to advance the state interest of diversity? Because there's this thing called
I think before we talk about Backe, we got to talk about strict scrutiny.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, Teen, you want to take that?
Well, the way I thought of it, and correct me if I'm I'm just trying to follow the outline. I know I wrote it. But you know, it's been helpful to me. So you can tell me if it's not helpful. Really broad strokes. A big part of the case was simply about, were Asian American applicants unfairly discriminated against, right?
Yes.
So that's what it entails. It's a fairly straightforward case that nominally Asian American plaintiffs brought claiming racial discrimination against them.
Yes.
And
more importantly, nobody really denied that Asian students were being discriminated against. Right.
Yeah, there was
nobody
a lot
really
of
denies
cases,
that because
and I'll
if
call
they
out
denied just... that, if they denied that, then we there would be no case.
Because yeah, you have
if
to
they had
presuppose
one on the basis,
this.
If they had won on the basis that there was no injury to Asian Americans, which Harvard did claim at the district court level where this lawsuit was filed in Boston, right? So what happened was SFFA and these Asian students filed a lawsuit saying that they were discriminated against and suffered harm because of it. And then Harvard filed to dismiss that lawsuit, saying that there was no evidence of discrimination. And while the trial court, the district court, that first level court, ultimately decided for Harvard and against the plaintiffs, at what they call the dismissal level or at the summary judgment level, when it was at the stage of the lawsuit where the plaintiffs had to prove or demonstrate that they were discriminated against, the court found in their favor, said, no, there's enough here. There is a clear pattern of discrimination here that we're going to have to look, that we are going to have to move towards the later stages of this where we're going to start doing subpoenas and we're going to start compelling Harvard to turn over documents. There's enough here to force them to do that. Right. So there is, you're right. Like the basis of this is that there, that Asian American students were being discriminated against, and that was sort of like, that's at, by the time it got to the Supreme Court, that's just assumed. We've already at this point basically stipulated to that happening. No one, like Harvard is no longer arguing, or UNC is no longer arguing that Asian American students are being discriminated against. But what they are arguing is that they're doing so in a lawful manner.
Yeah, where we come to the concept of strict scrutiny. Do you want to give us the strict scrutiny? You want to give us the rundown on that?
Yeah. So, you know, if you notice in the opinions, you'll see a lot of like upfront references to the Civil War, right? Like ever since the Civil War, this and that. That is because after this, we have these what are called the Civil War Amendments. And it wasn't until the 14th Amendment came in the late 1800s after the Civil War, where you have this concept that, you know, regardless of race, it doesn't mention race, but it just says all, it's called the Equal Protection Clause. I don't have the exact wording in front of me, but it basically says that laws cannot be applied differentially to people. They have to be applied equally to people, right? But then there's this whole complicated history after where there were specific programs like the Freedmen's Bureau and stuff that was set up to help freed slaves along with other people. And so there's this historical debate as to after the 14th Amendment, are laws allowed to are they allowed to be like race conscious, right? Like if we're going to set up like a specific program, government program to help freed slaves, isn't that not a colorblind law because you're specifically helping freed black slaves? So there's this whole debate, and it's a complicated debate. It's not an easy one. But, you know, and the classic example of a law, which I think a lot of the justices brought up, I forgot the name of the case, but there was one where the warden of a state penitentiary segregated the prisoner population by race. And so someone sued and said that that's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It's a state-run facility, and they've segregated us. And the prison warden said, the prison said, well, there's been really unmanageable levels of interracial violence. And so the only way that we could, you know, stop this was basically to segregate the population by race. And that passed the test of what they call strict scrutiny, which is a court-made doctrine of review where there is a discriminatory law out there, either de facto, which means like by effect, or prima facie, means like it actually says that it's discriminatory, which affirmative action is prima facie discriminatory because Harvard is saying, yes, we use race, right? Which we will talk about later, why they say that. But when you have a discriminatory law, on its face, it's violating the Constitution. It's violating the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. That's where I think a lot of people don't understand. Like, Harvard is on the back foot here. They have violated on its face the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It itself concedes that. Everyone agrees to this. But what they're saying is, the way I've done it passes what's called the strict scrutiny test, similar to the prison warden saying what he did. And it's just a simple two-prong test. The first is there like a compelling state interest in play here? Like, what is the reason for you to be doing this? It better be good, because you are engaging in prohibited racial or sexual or religious discrimination, what have you, right? Discrimination in what we call a protected class. So you're violating one of the core protections of the Constitution. Number one prong of strict scrutiny is you better have a good reason. Is there a compelling state interest? And then the second prong of that is also very simple, which is, okay, well, if you have a compelling state interest, is your discriminatory law or policy, whatever, is it narrowly tailored to actually further that state interest? Are you actually achieving what you want to do in the least discriminatory way possible? And if you can convince the court on both accounts, then the court will find in your favor that it is not violating the Equal Protection Clause. And so this is obviously going to be a highly contested area of the law. And the reason that we even have strict scrutiny is because we've ran up against very practical problems with the notion that all laws should be colorblind all the time. Because there are times when we're trying to do something that makes a lot of sense, And, you know, we're trying to, like, prevent people from killing each other, or we're trying to help freed slaves get their lives, you know, get their life started, you know, in a post-Civil War, you know, environment. Or we're trying to help integrate the schools, and Black students need an extra amount of help or assistance. And affirmative action comes out of that. It comes out of the idea that after we had centuries of slavery and Jim Crow laws and Black codes and, you know, full-on segregation under Plessy, that we needed to do something to help Black students, you know, get a foothold in our system of education. That's the origin of affirmative action. And that was sort of, quote, what was at stake.
Right. And then in Backe, using that test, who's the justice who kind of like led that opinion?
I think it was Powell.
Powell.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So he says,
I say it like I didn't know that 2 days ago.
Well, hey, Jess, you probably know more than that, than like 99% of the Twitterati out there. But so he says, okay, we got to have affirmative action, but we cannot base it on the idea to, like you mentioned, a Freedmen Bureau. We can no longer really say we're doing it to redress the wrongs we did against the slaves or their children, because, you know, time has passed, and it's like, how much longer can we, you know, what are we going to do? Like some kind of, I guess, DNA test to see who's a slave. And if you're white, what if you didn't own slaves? What if you're like a European immigrant or like is from South America or whatever? So he says, actually, no, what we got to do now is say the real reason for affirmative action is there's a state interest in diversity. Diversity helps schools provide better education, helps. Back it was a medical school, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Doctors, you know, you got to know how to treat people of different races, or, you know, bedside manner improves, whatever. And that was always kind of like an iffy thing, because he was the only one who said that, right? Because there were other concurring justices, but there were...
Yeah, and I think his view of diversity was a little different. Well, I think his version, his idea of diversity in that case is a little different than our current vision of like this sort of like Benetton diversity, right? I have to reread the opinion, but I gather he was talking more about creating like a professional, like... We're talking about medical schools in that case. It made sense that if you have a society that's as diverse as ours, we're going to need to train a diverse set of doctors that kind of reflects society. Like, we can't just have all white doctors, you know? Like, I think that's what he was trying to get at. But that kind of morphed later into diversity for diversity's sake, which is something
I think that's pretty similar to the reason. Like, because I read the, First Circuit Report, and they were describing all these like reports that Harvard relied on, like the Corona report, and they were all saying, you know, in these days, you know, corporations, they want to hire people who know how to deal with diverse groups of people. So, you know, if that's what Powell said, it seems pretty similar to what people are trying to justify it now.
Perhaps. I think that there has been a shift, though, where they're, you know, this it might be interesting. Well, I don't know, but like, I think he also probably wanted to avoid the idea that there was a case for reparations and that past injustices and crimes and, you know, genocides and slavery need to be redressed in the laws. I think that opened up a Pandora's box for them. And they were like, that's a little dangerous.
You know? It's like, okay, how long, like, where's the limit? And then we get to that in Grutter, where, you know, like Sandra Day O'Connor actually sets kind of like a 25-year limit, sort of. But yeah, I think his worry was, you know, as time goes on, how can you be saying you're redressing past wrongs to, you know, generations that are getting more removed from the original crime?
Yeah. So going back to strict scrutiny, so the ruling basically said that Harvard and UNC's case could not pass strict scrutiny, right? And one of the things that stuck out is that because their rationale for their use of race in admissions, again, going back to what Teen said, they are both admitting that they used race in their admissions policies. So the idea that they were discriminating, however you want to interpret that word, is just that was not being contested at all. What they presented as their justifications for the use of race in admissions is a handful of things. Training future leaders, the acquisition of new knowledge based on diverse outlooks, a robust marketplace of ideas, and producing engaged and productive citizens. And it seems like the majority found that these interests, they can't be subject to judicial review. So they fail on the first leg of strict scrutiny, right? Like, you can't even determine if there's a compelling interest there if you can't really examine their rationale concretely. Is that correct?
Or anything like that?
But see, that's what makes this a seminal case.
Yeah.
Right. Because a lot of affirmative action programs have been struck down in the courts. They don't all make it to the Supreme Court. But affirmative action programs, you know, and I'm talking about race conscious admissions programs for higher learning, both undergrad and grad school, some survive strict scrutiny and some do not. And, you know, I gave you the example, Jess, of the Banneker-Keith Scholarship at the University of Maryland, which I won in 1996, and I attended the school on a full scholarship that just the year before had been earmarked only for Black students. And I thought that that was a great thing. I thought that if the University of Maryland wanted to attract highly qualified Black students onto campus, and they thought that that was something that was really important to them as a school, well, they put their money where their mouth is, and they said, well, then we're going to have a scholarship, and we're going to pay you, we're going to fund your entire college experience, but we're looking for highly qualified Black students. And that the court struck down as being too, it's too close to a quota. You can't do that. I mean, this is a very like
this wishy-washy. This is for students that were already admitted, though?
No. Oh, yes. They applied, and then they would look at this pool, and if there was a Black student that they were like, we really want this person on campus, right? Okay. This is a great student, and they're Black, and we want them on campus. Now, that is the definition to me of using race as a plus, not a minus. You're giving that person money. That's a plus. You're not taking money away from me, right? And so this is a student who otherwise, you know, is fully qualified to go to that school. And not only that, has demonstrated, you know, exceptional academic achievement. And they're going to go and try and lure them onto campus with money. And they got struck down. It didn't survive strict scrutiny. It happens all the time. But that was not a seminal case. I mean, you're not going to find, oh my God, they struck down this affirmative action program. Why? Because it failed on the second prong. Right. Like, it failed. These are things that fail on the second prong. And I sent you that link, and it said that I think it was the Fourth Circuit that found that it was not narrowly tailored. Right. It wasn't narrowly tailored enough to achieve that, to achieve their interest in the first prong. And so I think Bakke had really established what the first prong is, and basically saying that, yeah, it is a compelling state interest to have a diverse incoming class. And so you can use race as a factor, but it's the second prong that we're going to actually be reviewing to make sure that you're doing a narrowly tailored program where you can't have discriminatory quotas. You can't do this. You can only use race as a positive. And I think that that's where the sort of inherent unworkability of strict scrutiny kind of comes into play, because it's like, okay, that's how we get into regression analyses that, you know, two hired mathematicians come to completely different conclusions as to whether Asians are actually being discriminated. One says, yes, they're facing horrific discrimination. The other comes out and saying, no, actually, if you controlled this variable like you should have, you'll see that they aren't facing any discrimination. And yeah, I don't know who to believe.
Yeah, I was trying to spend like yesterday trying to understand what the hell was going on. You got that card guy who's the Harvard guy who was saying,
"Oh,
no,
if it's the report that I'm thinking of, maybe send it to me." They make a mistake. They make an average of an average.
Wait, Jess, what are you talking about?
I I remember reviewing this a little while ago, so my memory, so like, don't quote me on this or anything. Of course, I'm saying it like on a recorded pod, but just don't quote me on this. But I remember having some trouble with that one because it looked like they were using the same numbers twice. They were using an average of an average to then compile an index.
Yeah, that thing was impossible to understand.
But here's the thing. I think that a lot of Asian people looking at this and having to go through these analyses and spot problems in the way that some statistician made an average out to claim that either Asian students weren't facing discrimination or were or whatever is infuriating in a way, because it's like, look, obviously we fucking are. Okay, like, if you just look at the stats, it is clear that Asian American students are being held to a different academic standard than everyone else. Not just Black, not just Latino, but also white students. Asian Americans we have to score like 60, 70, 80 points higher than a white student, and et cetera, till we start getting equal admit rates, right? So there is clear discrimination. The very fact that we're even getting to this second prong analysis, where we bring in all these experts and we're looking at whether the and it's like really getting really like rhetorical and, you know, only pluses but no negatives. It's, you know, it's like, and Roberts had rightfully said in his opinion that that's absolute nonsense. It's like, what difference does it make? You know,
well, also, because when you're talking about admissions to exclusive spots, a plus for someone is a negative for you.
Yeah, it's a negative. It's
absolutely,
yeah,
zero.
It's a zero sum admissions game. Obviously, there's only so many spots, right? So if I give stickers to everyone except the Asian students, right? Okay, well, it's a positive to everyone else. I need a negative. You know, the fact that we're even mired in this kind of debate and this level of argumentation is a slap in the face to a lot of Asians, and I feel this way because what they're saying is, no, this is an argument worth having. No, I know you're being discriminated against, but let's hear him out. Let's hear him out. And I think that the reason this is such a seminal case, it is a seminal case, is because unlike all the other ones where they're mired in the second prong analysis of whether this thing is narrowly tailored to further this state interest in there being a diverse campus, this did away with the first prong. This said that there is no compelling state interest to this form of discrimination, no matter how well your statistician comes out to defend it. You're pursuing an illegitimate goal. So you can throw all of your statistical reports out the window. I don't care about it. Because that's second prong analysis. That's us assuming that there is some legitimacy to be had here in discriminating against Asian American students. So it's like, okay, hey, these Asian students were rejected because they're Asian. And that's awful, yes. But let's hear the case as to why that's a good thing. And I think the fact that we even got to the point of saying, well, let's hear as to why that's a good thing, really felt like there's something fundamentally wrong here. There's something fundamentally wrong here. And I think when you start reading these cases, this is why I would recommend people read these cases, understand where we're starting from. We're starting from the proposition under the Constitution that the laws, that we should be all treated equally under the law, regardless of race. That is the ideal. That is the Constitution. Without any, there's no real like debate about that. Okay, it is absolutely about equal treatment under the law. And all of these cases about affirmative action, about Asian American students having to face higher, you know, admission standards, is absolutely 100% unmitigated, like uncontested by all sides. The fact that an Asian student will be treated differently for admission into a university, which is by the operation of law, state policy, right? We can talk about why. It's very complicated, but these are state policies. That the Asian students are being held to a higher standard because of race, period. I don't need to hear any more about this is how we talk about it in the back room, in the admissions room. We don't say race. You know, we don't. It's like, no, I see your fucking stats. Asian students have to score at least 100 points higher than the white students. Why is that? Tell me, explain. And then you hear a million fucking arguments from them as to why you're insane for even bringing it up. And I'm like, read the case. The whole point of having this debate is that you admitted that you are in violation of the Equal Protection Clause, but that you should be allowed to do it. And that's why Harvard, you know, weirdly, they're fighting this case to say they want to be able to use race as a factor. Why are they even fighting this case and spending, I think, $30 million doing it? Why are they even arguing it? But then at the same time, claiming that not a single applicant decision, admissions decision, was ultimately decided on the basis of race. In other words, race didn't really matter. Why would Harvard claim that race didn't matter and then spend $30 million defending affirmative action? That's a very interesting question to me. And I think part of it is that they are actually fighting for not just the practical aspects of these sort of holistic admissions, which they will continue to do. And they'll just take out of account grades and SATs. So you can no longer put these matrices together as to how, you know, Asian students score higher on the SATs and GPA than other students. Okay. So they'll still do their holistic things. They'll still be able to get the classes that they want and achieve the diversity that they want, just like UC Berkeley was able to do it despite Prop 209. But why were they so defending this law? And I think it's because this is a much bigger fight than just affirmative action. This has to go with core interpretations of the Constitution that go back 160 years at this point, you know, 150 years. Yeah. This is it's an ideological war. This is not just about admissions.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of just how incomprehensible that second prong is, just to give a little bit detail, one of the most contentious issues with the Harvard admissions that they had like these six buckets of scores that they would give applicants. So it'd be like academics, extracurriculars, athletics, personal score, which is the big thing with Asian Americans. I forget the fifth one. There was another one called school support. School support is essentially your teacher's recommendations and other kinds of, you know, things that attest to your personal character. Asian Americans actually scored really high in academics and extracurriculars, which was really funny to me because, like, when I was in high school, the stereotype against Asian applicants was we were only good at academics, like extracurriculars. They were saying, "Yo, go join more clubs." I guess because we took that advice, and now we're excelling at the extracurriculars. But school support, the Asian Americans, very good. Interviews. That was the other one. Alumni interviews. Did, you know, very well. These were not contested issues. It was just this personal score thing, which was this thing that was given by the admissions officers at Harvard that attested various things about a student or applicants, just like likability, whether this person was a good person to know, whatever the fuck that means, leadership, inspiration, whatever, narrative and all that. And, you know, they asked, like, why is this markedly lower for Asian Americans and markedly high for, like, say, Black students, especially when you compare Asian Americans to their score and the personal scores with the school support scores. And it was just like, I was reading the decision and it said, well, you know, the Asian students, their teachers' recommendations might have been a little bit worse than white students, but that might have been because, you know, most Asian Americans, you know, especially compared to the high scoring white students, tend to go to public schools where the guidance counselors and teachers are more, they got to deal with like thousands of students as opposed to like a couple hundred. And all that. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? How are we supposed to then determine this? It is purposely to throw you into this impossible analysis of, you got to find out where, you know, all that bullshit. So,
Well, in discovery, I mean, it's in the footnotes of the ruling, I think. They capture like fragments of emails passed around by admissions officers.
Wait, are you talking about the joke email by the Thomas Hibino guy to the William Fitzsimmons?
I don't know anything about that. I'm talking about the footnotes of the ruling, the SSFFA ruling. Oh, okay. Where they do snippets of admissions officers basically.
Heck no, Asian one. Really like.
Yeah, like, oh yeah, got another Asian, you know, got another Asian in the bucket.
You got a brown, you know, girl here.
Yeah.
It's when they talk about we're doing the crucial work, which is what Justice Jackson said. I'm like, what crucial work? These are a bunch of like white people sitting in the back room of like in some Harvard admissions building saying, I got a brown girl. I mean, really?
This, this, yeah. This, and then this, like, this is, yeah, like,
what all this hype.
Oh yeah, yeah, Jess. What I'm talking about? There was a article in the New Yorker that came out, I think, several months ago. It was written by Jeannie Suk Gerson. It was about her trying to get this one email exchange between this guy named Thomas Sabino, who was I forgot what head of agency it was, but it was essentially in charge of one of its duties, like overseeing Harvard's like admissions policies or whatever. He had sent an email to William Fitzsimmons, who's what is he, like Harvard's like dean of admissions. Okay, Dean of Admissions. And not only did Harvard try to seal it or like hide it, but the District Court of Massachusetts was working very hard to seal it. So, you know, Gerson was like, well, this whole case depends on whether you can trust Harvard behind closed doors to not be biased against Asian Americans. And there's this thing that might reveal that, and you're trying to hide it, it destroys a lot of credibility in your case, and eventually she gets access to it. And it's about, it's kind of like this, you know, stupid joke where it involves like some hypothetical Filipino American student has all these like hardships, but you know, it just, again, another piece that shows what, you know, that heck no Asian thing, or you know, whether the SAT stats, it all just adds up to all these like pieces of evidence. And it, you know, the whole piece is about, this thing is all about how much can we trust, I mean, not only Harvard, but UNC and other elite colleges, how much can we trust them? And all these things say you can't. And you got all these so-called progressives lining up to be human shields for these institutions.
For Harvard.
Harvard. Which any other day, they will say are perpetuators of classism, elitism, misogyny, whatever. But on this one thing, they can do no wrong. Like,
yeah,
how
and,
dare
I mean,
you question
they act like, and this is, you know, it's so, it's. I feel like people who make accusations are often the ones who are actually guilty of the thing that they're accusing people of, which is that Asians are creating inter POC conflict by doing this. That we are, that the Asian, you know, the Asian plaintiffs in this case, and any Asian who supports them, and having their day in court. Which we can talk about the reactions to this later too, which has just been abominable. But that they're sowing discord between POC because we're like, you know, we're scabs. We're like basically not. And I'm like, no, actually, they make it seem like this is SFFA versus black people.
No. You see this? Like, if you read
SFFA versus fucking Harvard.
Have you guys read Justice Jackson's dissent?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so it's essentially her outlining the history of wrongs done against black people. So the way I think to understand these people's by these people, I mean the people, the Harvard apologists here. To them, this is a black versus white issue, just like Jackson's dissent is saying this is like all the wrongs done against black people. And here come these Asians with their annoying interests. How dare they not take it on the chin.
But did she really say that, or are you?
I'm not saying she said that. But okay. Obviously, she's a Supreme Court justice. She's not going to say that. But the way she frames it, there's a black and white issue. That's what it ultimately comes down to. Like, these white people have done black people wrong, and this is what they owe them. And these Asians, these Johnny and Janie come latelys with their annoyingly high SAT scores and everything.
Bunch of grade grubbers.
A bunch of great grubbers. You know, they should be grateful that they're allowed in the country in the first place. Haven't we given them enough? Fuck, we gave Everything Everywhere All at Once an Oscar. How much more can they want? And that's the way they frame it. And that's how I think you have to understand. Because, I mean, J. Caspian King recently wrote a piece for The New Yorker where he said, hey, you know, Asians are supposedly the plaintiffs here. And Asian Americans are getting a lot of the hate for this. But nobody is actually talking about them. Or us, you know.
Okay,
it's
Let's roll it back some because we just touched on a lot of things. So just to recap up to this point, laws is really hard for me. I don't know. So what the ruling is saying that this Harvard and UNC their policies could not pass strict scrutiny. And they were able to make their case under a provision of Bakke. That's the case in Bakke. There were like six things that the University of California claimed it had. It should be allowed It should be allowed to have final say over as to the composition of its student body. All of it was struck down except for one provision, which is that there is some nominal educational benefit to diversity in its classes. And that was allowed to stand. And that's the thing that Harvard and UNC...
That's the compelling state interest, prong one of strict scrutiny.
Yeah. So
I think the way to think about it is that most cases are focused on prong two, and they just take for granted when a university says, well, we do this in the name of diversity, and they'll cite Bakke, and they'll be like, okay, or they'll cite Grutter and this, you know, the critical mass theory of diversity, and they'll say, okay, we'll go with Grutter. We'll go with Bakke. Prong one, satisfied. Prong one kind of became like, I mean, what is affirmative action? I mean, nobody really has a great definition of affirmative action. I think the best definition of it probably means race-conscious decisions for admissions to higher, you know, institutional higher learning that use the diversity justification for prong one of strict scrutiny as derived from Grutter and Bakke and, you know, in related cases, but mainly those two.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what affirmative action is, meaning it's a preset, pre-approved prong one, compelling state interest. And you just say that. It's just like a pro forma thing. Like you just say it, and then you get to prong two. Was it narrowly tailored? That was affirmative action.
Yeah, that sounds mm-hmm. fair. And it's in this case is significant by saying that that provision is actually we probably do have to defer to these schools to have final say for the composition of its student bodies, but not at the expense of any particular group. That means, you know, race as a negative was prohibited by Bakke or Grutter, or maybe both. I'm not sure. Basically saying that you cannot use race as a negative, and that's what's being argued here. So the nominal educational benefit of racial diversity kind of implies stereotyping, right? That they are arguing that just having it implies that the critical part, the important part about diversity on campus is that there are people of different races. But what that boils down to is assuming that people of a certain race have some ineffable characteristic that everyone in that race shares.
Yeah, but we're still in narrowly tailored prong two territory, meaning like what you're talking about is things that we need to discuss as a court. When we've already established that what we're doing is justified in the name is at least like the nature of what we're doing is justified under this idea that the state has a compelling interest in the diversity of the class of, you know, of admits. And okay. the majority opinion here by Roberts, I thought this could be up for debate, right? And they always are. But I thought Roberts was pretty clearly saying that diversity is just, it's far too, like, hard to measure and amorphous. And it's like, not only is it hard to measure, but, like, if it's hard to measure, how are we even going to have a meaningful prong two debate as to how you're achieving this? Like, how do you even measure diversity? Is it purely just racial diversity? Because if that's the case, then it sounds like we're just looking at something along the lines of a quota system. You're saying that's not what you want to do, right? So I think that...
Yeah, and it calls into question other, like, Harvard's policies as aggressively, like, religion blind.
Yeah. Right, so I think what is going on here is the court is basically saying no more of these kinds of litigations. No, like, we do not want to have our courts engaged in this type of back and forth over whether race was, you know, this like very rhetorically clever and tricky discussion about whether race was used as a positive or a negative. I mean, I think he was right to be like, what are you even talking about? How do
I actually disagree with that. Maybe we can get in. I'm just outlining the things that I saw as why this ruling.
You can disagree with it, but I think that that's what they were saying. It's like we're not having these discussions anymore. There is no more like, you know, automatic, like, you know, there's no more consideration at the court level, you know, as to whether what you're doing is, you know, kosher under the name of diversity.
Okay. I mean, yeah, generally I think I agree.
Agree or disagree. I'm just saying that that's what the holding is here.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't matter what you think or I think because we're not judges.
Well,
that, you know, like
no, I'm not talking. I'm not
throwing the hammer down.
What you're saying is true. I'm not sure what that'll mean for future litigation. I that's way beyond me. I'm just listing the things that I saw as why they ruled the way they ruled. So the first thing it said was it doesn't pass strict scrutiny. They kind of overturned Bakke and Grutter. The one thing that was allowed to stay on the books from there, because these schools used race as a negative against Asians specifically, and by necessity deploys mass stereotyping, which were already outlawed in prior precedent. They weren't limited in duration. People talk about the 25-year thing in Grutter. I'm not sure how people seem to talk about it as some kind of binding thing, like Sandra Day O'Connor writing that, she expects that, you know, race-based consideration should have like a 25-year sunset. Like she doesn't anticipate it needing to be a thing in 25 years. But neither Harvard nor UNC were able to prove that they had any plan to sunset. Like, how are you measuring progress against your own metrics for diversity? Are you getting closer or further
away? What a cop-out of a thing to say, too. Yeah, you could discriminate against Asian students, but only for 25 years.
Yeah, and they were arguing like, oh, well, we thought we weren't going to get challenged until 2028. Okay, so you wanted a free pass to screw over Asian kids until 2028?
Yeah. So I guess in that case, the plaintiffs were white, but whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, in this case, yeah, but they're arguing that, oh, we thought we had 25 years before we had to think about this. Like, fuck you. Yeah.
It's just such a stupid thing to write.
So long story short, this is the ruling just establishes at heart, Asian applicants faced discrimination in the application process, like full stop, right?
Well, no, that's a district court level finding.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
at that point, it's already in the record and, you know.
Yeah. Okay, I guess this is more reacting to popular opinion about this, mm-hmm. that it's a ruling like stripping back rights for Black people. Like, no, that was not the meat of this case here. Just purely separating fact from fiction here in this case.
Depends on what they think, you know, rights for Black people means.
Well, I mean, like to talk about this in an intellectually honest way, it means that you have to accept the discrimination against Asian students happened. Whether you cannot, the only thing in question here is whether you see that as a good or a bad thing. Like there's a whole side that doesn't want to admit the discrimination. So there's a whole side that says discrimination didn't happen, but it kind of should. Right. There's another side that says discrimination did happen. And very few people are actually willing to say this because that just doesn't sound great. And they default to saying that it's actually mass discrimination against Black people or brown people in this case. Asians are supposed to just kind of take the L and stay quiet about it.
But I think that is the mainstream position. If you look at, you know, the standard Asian American liberal response to this is, yeah, you got called like a boring chink by William Fitzsimmons, but hey, you got into Berkeley, you got into Amherst. What the hell are you complaining about? I think that is the mainstream position that, like, as I said, in the Jackson dissent, this is a Black versus white issue. We Asian Americans, even a lot of Asian Americans saying this, should just stay the fuck out and know your place. And be grateful you're kind of let in the first place. And when the actual people who matter the most are fighting over it, stay the hell out. Yeah. Don't make us look bad. And now you've ruined it for the rest
because,
of us.
That's because Asian liberals, by and large, are amoral strivers.
Who've also gained access to the system.
Right. They don't care. I mean, until I would like to think about it more. It depends on who's affected, right? So let's say that their kid goes to a very expensive private daycare, and that day, let's say it's 30% Asian, and you know 60% white, and then 10% other. And on a given day, like a certain teacher, let's say she's a white teacher, a white lady, because that's you know who they hate the most, hands out merit stickers to this class of like you know. 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds. And every student gets 5 stickers, except all the Asian students only get 3. They're going to throw a fucking fit. Are you kidding me? They will throw a fucking fit. You know? And they're right to. They would be right to. Because do stickers matter? Right? Could they have gone elsewhere and bought their own stickers? Why do I even want stickers from a white lady? It's all irrelevant. But those are the things that they're saying about. You know, when you say like, okay, well, he ended up going to Berkeley. What does he have to complain about? Well, that's like, well, you bought your kid an extra two stickers at the dollar store. What does your kid have to complain about? The point isn't that racial discrimination is okay if it doesn't ruin your life. You know, the point is that like, this is just completely unjustified. You're just discriminating against people based because of their race. And you're saying that, okay, well, I can, you know, I as, you know, myself being a Harvard educated liberal or whatever, like, I think I'm strong enough to take that kind of discrimination. You know, I don't need to go to Harvard. My kid doesn't need to go to Harvard. We could still be good people. And it just completely throws out like any moral or ethical consideration here. Now, if they wanted to debate this at a moral and ethical level, fine, but they don't. You know, they're just literally like, I see Jeff Yang like just pile onto this kid, Calvin. You know what he said? He was like, oh, you know what? I just found out this kid's Canadian. He was like, I'm not trying to bag on Canadians, but if you want to come to this country and ruin like what we fought so hard to establish here, why don't you maybe just do that in Canada? And I'm like, what the fuck?
Not only that,
what about you being a more grateful second-class immigrant?
What is this fucking stupid asshole talking about?
Not only
Jeff
that,
Yang is a stupid asshole.
Not only that, but he, it'd be one thing if like his own kid couldn't get into Harvard and he had to go to like UMass Amherst. And I'm okay with that. Then, you know, but I'd be like, okay, you walk the walk. But you know what? His kid got into Harvard. And then he had a horrible tweet thread where he's like saying, he got in because he sold a TV pilot about cooking with his grandma. And it was so heartfelt that that you know people bought it, as if that had nothing to do with the fact that Hudson Yang was star of Fresh Off the Boat, which I'm sure had something to do with the connection that he had with Jeff Yang, who for whatever reason for like over 20 years has been some kind of cultural spokesperson for Asian Americans. It's just so fucking appalling that it'd be one thing if we were being like guided by, let's say, people who had not gone to these schools, had to go to their more, you know, let's say local state schools, but now had ascended to, you know, position of power. All the reasons that whether you're like a working class Asian American or, you know, very rich, the reason why everyone, including these Asian American liberals, want to go to these schools, saying, hey, you know what? I went to University of Colorado Boulder or whatever, and now I'm this great person. Here's how you can do it. Fuck these Ivy Leagues. Here's like, but no, all we ever fucking hear from are the Jeff Yangs, the Jennifer Lees, all the people who went to Harvard, went to Columbia, and their kids go to these
without
fucking,
fail. They've already gone. They already went to the school,
and they're saying, "You great grubbers, why don't you learn your place? Why don't you go to your community college or
that's
whatever?"
Why are you ruining my
reputation with my non-Asian friends?
That's why Jeannie Suk Gerson is the only, I think, like, you know, Asian American academic in those circles. She's a Harvard law professor who has any ounce of intellectual honesty about this because she is a law professor, because she understands like the actual arguments and history of what's being litigated here. And, you know, I read her New Yorker article and I didn't think it was anything that special, except that she didn't engage in totally fucking dishonest arguments. And she just sort of like covered it the way, you know, a calm, rational law professor would do it, right?
Well, I thought she, in the end, she was like saying, look, this ruins Harvard's reputation. Well, she didn't like say that strongly, but saying, look, this doesn't look good for Harvard. Yeah. You know, this is like an innocent entity would not be doing this. I thought that was her ultimate conclusion.
But that, I mean, I think she's agreeing with that there were aspects to this that, you know, were justified. The ruling was justified. But I'm saying, like, you know, I don't think that she gave a very like politicized view of this. I think she was just giving the like a lawyer's view of it, like a law professor's view. And a lot of law professors who like know the case well or know understand this well, you know, they don't talk about it in such like explosive, you know, bombastic terms.
But well, it doesn't support it. Just reading the ruling, it's far more prosaic than the emotional hysteria it's provoked in the media.
But the Asian American studies complex. But the Asian American studies complex, I think it's the professors that find themselves. I know your mother's a sociologist. I'm excluding your mother from this. But I think it's the sociology department that is producing some of the worst Asian American academics, like the Janelle Wongs of the world.
Yeah, we'll get to her in a second.
And the Jennifer Lee.
I talked to my mom privately, and it's just, she's not part of that whole complex, I'm proud to say.
Yeah, and I think maybe your mom luckily predated this. I would say that there is a cultural thing going on. Now I'm starting to sound like part of the IDW Ben Shapiro thing, but there is such a thing as woke culture. We know it. And it is found. It is taking root in part, in parts of the, academic of the elite academic institutions. And I do think it's starting to it finds itself more, I think, in the softer sciences. And it's spreading from there. But I think it takes root at most in places where I think there isn't a clear, this, when I say soft sciences, I mean there isn't like a really rigid tradition and mode of analysis like the way you would find, like, say, in the hard sciences. And I would say in law, it's not as easy for it to take hold in law, but it is taking hold there as well.
I mean, law is pretty procedural. There's some hardbound rules that you have to follow. I think reading, like understanding law, became easier for me if I started to see it as having like if I actually kind of saw it as code, like software.
It's very a lot of it is. I mean, especially it is when you talk about rule sources sets, of law,
a defined output, an input. I mean, that's very procedural. It's very rigid and
categories
precise.
And class and I mean by not social class, but coding class.
Yes.
Very much. Yeah.
But I mean, just going back to the whole, our whole like intellectual class here, or the anti-intellectual class, as an Asian American, I would actually feel a lot more, if they could only just be honest about this, right? I saw a Democracy Now! Clip that had Janelle Wong in it. And, of course, all of your seats are going to be in the show notes, et cetera. I would feel so much better if they, and she's been the strongest about, there's a piece written by her and Viet Thanh Nguyen in the LA Times that goes in really hard on claiming that Asian Americans actually were not facing discrimination in the admissions process. A, that means your piece is entirely stands on nothing, absolutely nothing.
If they weren't actually facing discrimination, then there shouldn't even be a court case to talk about.
There would be absolutely nothing. And two, if we can just accept that it did happen, but it's presented as like, okay, Asians, you're taking it on the chin right now. This is an L, but there is a grander project of justice, racial, racial reparations, remedial remedies for past wrongs. You are part of this progressive push for justice for all and a true definition of equality and equity in the United States. I could potentially see that. That includes me in this whole process. It's saying there is a sacrifice, we acknowledge it, but this is in service of some greater purpose. Not to say I'd accept it as like I'd be okay with it, but at least
not personally. And it's a different calculus when it's your own kid.
Absolutely.
We can all be fucking, heroes in our imagination. I would die on the, but when it comes to your kid, I think a lot of parents, and this is being driven, I think, by parents and not necessarily 18, 19-year-old kids, we don't like to see our kids being discriminated against.
That is a hill you should, that is not a hill you should try to fight on.
And because of the race of me and my partner.
Clarence Thomas points that out, the absolute illogic and inflammatory nature of a culture war being waged on what amounts to people's children. This is not a recipe for social harmony at all. In fact, it's antithetical to promoting social harmony.
Yeah. But just, I don't think that option would even be allowed, because then that would mean people, especially like other minority groups, especially Black people, would then owe something to Asian Americans. That is absolutely not allowed in the progressive ideology. We must always be the eternally grateful immigrants. And the notion that, because then if you do say, okay, you know what? We're going to kind of, basically, we're going to let you have this, puts you in a position of power. That is absolutely not allowed. So you must, that's why the whole Harvard thing is predicated on the, and UNC, we always forget about UNC, I'll throw in UNC there, is a predicate on, no, it's your fault. It's your fault that you cannot inspire the ad comms into liking you more or whatever. It cannot ever be acknowledged that, hey, you are being magnanimous and taking one for the team. That can absolutely never be acknowledged.
No, it's because you have shitty personalities. That's what Harvard literally said. Not only is the proposition in the arguments that using race as a factor is important to address, you know, and I think they did make that claim that they need to address historical wrongs, though. What they really, you know, the more compelling argument in court at, up until this point was diversity. But the point of that, yes, Asian Americans will have to make some sacrifices here was totally lost. Like, you're right. Harvard never said that about the Asian kids that they held to a higher standard. They just said, well, they have shittier personalities. Literally what they said, right? They have yeah. lower personality scores.
They gave two reasons. They said, first, it might be things out of our control. In other words, maybe the teachers just didn't like these Asian American kids as much as the other kids, which is kind of proven wrong by the fact that the school support scores for Asian Americans were not that much worse.
I think they were higher.
Or maybe higher. Even higher. I didn't quite look into that. But secondly, they also said, well, there might be some like cultural factors, which we all know what that means, you know.
Not leadership.
They were saying, like, not a good culture fit.
Look, I'm going to say this. We're at an hour 10 or whatever, and I'm going to say my last piece here because there's just too much to say about this. But it's this. It's like, look, your kid getting discriminated against in the admissions game, yes, it's not the end of the world. There are a lot of good schools that are going to be happy to have your kid with the 1500 SAT or the 1400 SAT or the 3.6 or 3. Whatever. They're going to get a fine education in America, okay? But the really sad part about this that actually breaks my heart is to see a culture in which we are telling Asian kids to accept discrimination against them as something that they just have to live with and that it's a good thing. And that it just tells you it's the beginning of a lifelong process of telling these people, educating these young Asian kids that they're not allowed to stand up for themselves on account of them being Asian. And doing so makes you a bad person.
Not just
and,
that.
And no, hold okay. on. If that's what you're teaching your kids, okay, that is a far greater harm. A far fucking greater harm than saying I have to go to the state school instead of Harvard or I had to go to whatever. It like I don't care about that. And the fact that, you know, people are accusing these people of being great, maybe some of them are, maybe I don't care. But I'm just saying that the lesson learned here, if the lesson learned is that the discrimination against Asian kids is a good thing and that those kids just have to learn, just internalize that as a good thing, that is a really, really deep injury that, you know, I think would take a lifetime to really overcome if you really buy into it. So I'm glad that there is a very forceful debate out in the, you know, out in the open now about this. I don't care about convincing people who are sure that that is the right thing, the Janelle Wong view of the world. But I want people to start speaking up and not being afraid of the label anti-Black racist. You have to know in your heart whether that's what you are or that's what you, whether you are anti-Black or whether you're just trying to stand up for yourself. What matters is like what's in your own heart, not what other people call you. And that, you know, that these are simple lessons, but that are hard to learn under this kind of social pressure. And some people are not going to survive it. Like, I mean, survive in the sense of, you know, come out with a sense of like, you know what? I trust myself, you know?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the pressure here is just about not letting Asian kids trust themselves and value themselves. And I fully fucking hate that shit. And I support everyone out there who is just trying to have their own view of this.
Yeah. No, yeah, very absolutely. Well said. But I will add, not only are they saying you have to accept discrimination, because it's one thing to tell like these Asian American kids, you got to accept discrimination from, like, say, the fucking Augusta Country Club. We all know that they're the bad guys, you know, whatever. This is Harvard, whom we are crowning as the supreme arbiters of progressive enlightened thought. You have to accept discrimination from that. And if you don't get accepted by these people, it's your own fucking fault. If that is what Asian American culture is, and I say it's an absolutely craven, cowardly culture, it is absolutely not worth saving. And I would say bomb it all down. Absolutely nothing worth saving about Asian American culture or whatever, Asian American liberal culture.
Not when these fucking people are the ones who are helming it and in charge of the fucking project.
It's grown adults. I mean, the thread between like Ouyen Poon and Jeff Yang, these are grown adults in their 40s and 50s who were inviting hate on a 19-year-old child.
Absolutely disgusting.
And these are the same people who get paid lots of money to be talking heads at any other point in time. Talk about not your model minority, how Asians have to fight against being second-class citizens, and then turn around and tell another Asian, a young Asian student who was simply pressing for his day in court to redress a perceived wrong, that no, you actually have to be okay with being a second-class citizen. Your rights do not deserve to be respected to the full extent of the law.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. Part two is going to be on the Patreon feed. If you want to be a Patreon supporter, just go to patreon.com/planamag.